Session this morning is on life insurance securitisation and wealth management securitisation. If you're in the wrong room, now's a good time to leave. Otherwise, you can stick it through anyway. We have two very good presenters this morning, Carolyn Bennett and Lawrence Heyman, who I've found out this morning don't work for Tribridge Deloitte. They work for Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants. They're going to have a presentation running for 20 to 25 minutes, which I think should leave us for another 20 to 25 minutes of question time. Leave your questions until the end. Please do ask questions, and we'll see a good discussion afterwards.
Thank you for coming to this session this morning. I guess our primary reason for choosing this topic was that this is an area that there's been a lot of development overseas and much less so here in Australia, with limited exception. And so we thought it was an interesting topic that there could be the potential for some discussion around and also some perspectives from overseas that we could share with the group as well. So we will run through a short presentation, as Eddie just mentioned. We'll start with just some background for the room around what is securitisation for those that aren't so familiar. We'll look at what you can actually use it for, then we'll cover some of the examples that we've seen here in Australia, and then also some of the overseas examples. And then finally, we'll close with, I guess, a range of questions that we hoped would prompt some discussion amongst the room, as well as, I guess, questions for us around where to from here. So in terms of what is securitisation, securitisation is the practice of issuing securities that you can trade on the markets, where the interest and repayment of principal on those securities is driven by a stream of cash flows that are predictable, but you don't actually know exactly what they will be. And so because of, I guess, the way in which it's defined, it can range from being quite fixed interest-like to being quite equity-like. And the objective of the transaction is really to execute some sort of transfer of risk to the markets away from your portfolio. But of course, that clearly will have a cost to you. Securitisation is obviously just one of many possible forms of raising capital that are available to companies in the market, ranging from ordinary shares, preference shares, sub-debt, and the very traditional reinsurance that is used most common or has been used most commonly to transfer risk. The availability, I guess, of many options is one of the reasons, I guess, that we may not have seen so much securitisation in Australia as perhaps we've seen overseas. And whether it versus any of those other options is, I guess, preferable will depend on a whole range of factors that has to be taken into account, including the regulatory attitude and whether securitisation is able to be structured in a way that will get the desired outcomes, whether the amount of capital is that's desired to be raised is actually achievable in both being big enough but not too big to be able to be raised. It also depends, of course, on what existing capital structures are in place and how a securitisation may fit within those. And then finally, clearly all of these options have a cost, and ultimately the company will want to achieve the optimal outcome in terms of cost and taking into account all the various elements of the capital structure. I'm now going to hand over to Lawrence to run through some of the more example-based discussion.
Thank you and good morning. I guess the uses of securitisation, I guess you can break it down into two major components. When companies looking to access capital, the typical reasons they have is that they might find that it comes at a lower cost. They might be looking to release some of the embedded value within the company. They could be looking to finance heavy initial new business expense, or potentially use it for a merger and acquisition. All of those points are not mutually exclusive. It's possible for one securitisation to do two or three of those things at once. And the other main branch could be potentially to pass risks back to the capital market And typically they're talking about a catastrophe bond, which is a lot more prevalent in general insurance, but it's quite possible and has been done within life insurance. I guess when we think of securitisation, it is quite a simple thing, and it's not actually changing what are the underlying risks that the company's running. It's also not changing the total capital need. So why would you do it? Well, it could potentially be that the investors that are out there might prefer something with a little bit less risk than equity, but more risk than just a typical fixed interest option, and you might find that, or the company might find that the risk return profile is more favourable to them. So I guess in a way it's looking to get to different areas of the capital market with just a different option. Some of the more recent securitisations that we've seen, this first one, Avondale Securities, was an embedded value transaction, and it was done by the Bank of Ireland. I guess one of the very interesting things to us is that they were actually able, at the bank parent level, they were able to call that Tier 1 capital, which is something that would be very relevant to a lot of Australian banks who own a life insurer. Another interesting thing about this securitisation is that it'll actually help them to fund new business as well. So once they've actually sold the business and it gets to a certain level, they can go to the market and issue further securities, which gives them that double use of an embedded value but also financing new business. Another interesting recent transaction that happened in 2006 was done for an M&A transaction. Scottish Re, which is actually based in the Cayman Islands, not Scotland, bought ING Re in the US. And typically with US securitisation, they're often targeted towards what they call triple X reserves, which are basically their reserves for things like mortality risk. And the US insurers tend to feel that those reserves are much too high. They're often set with mortality rates that were prevalent in the 1970s, and obviously mortality's improved. So a lot of US insurers feel that those reserves are too high. You can see from the size, it's a very large transaction, $1.6 billion. Another interesting point about it is they had a number of different tranches. They used quite a few different credit enhancement techniques within that securitisation. The other reason it caught my eye is that looking through Google, there was a number of articles about them having a ratings downgrade and that it was subprime related, which I thought was quite strange. But reading in, the main reason was that they'd invested a lot of their reserves into subprime securities. So it wasn't actually the reasons they were downgraded, was they lost money, not that they were a life insurance securitisation vehicle. Another very interesting securitisation was one done by AXA in France. It was a catastrophe bond, and it was based on mortality levels in three different countries. I think France was the major component. It was 60%. There was also, some of it was covering US and Japanese life insurance rates. Being a catastrophe bond, it basically works on a parametric trigger, so that once mortality exceeds a certain defined level, then the note holders are subject to a loss. It was also put into four different tranches, with some of it being denominated in euros and some of it being denominated in US dollars as well. There are a lot more transactions than just those three, and it is quite easy to find a lot more that has been happening in the marketplace. As Caroline said earlier, there hasn't been that much securitisation within life insurance in Australia. The only transaction that we know of that has been successful was done by CBA, but it was more on their funds management fees. and it was accessing the embedded value on those fees. It was initially offered to the public, but then was withdrawn at the time, and that was in 2005, and later CBA issued that in September 2006, but decided on public placement. I guess an interesting thing reading through the CBA annual report was that it wasn't counted within their Tier 1 or Tier 2 capital, but they mentioned it as an important other capital initiative that they released, and I guess being $700 million, it would be quite important even to a large organisation like CBA. So I guess moving along to securitisation in Australia and where it might be heading at the moment, as we've just seen, we've only had the one transaction so far. And I guess it's worth asking the question, why has it been used quite extensively overseas and not here in Australia? So a couple of the reasons that we could think of, and they're maybe not the only ones. I guess the recent history of the industry has been very good. Companies have been very profitable, and most companies haven't needed to access capital. The most recent time that a company did have financial trouble and needed to go to the market was back towards 2003 with Tower, and in that case they chose to go for ordinary equity, so I'm not sure if they would even have considered securitisation. I guess if you look at a number of the large insurers in Australia being bank owned, a number of them have actually been doing buybacks, so they obviously haven't needed capital, and that's actually turned around. I guess we all know about the subprime crisis, but a number of banks have cancelled future buybacks and are actually looking at issuing capital. Another reason for why it might not have happened so much in Australia is that most companies don't want to be the first one out there. Generally, I guess companies want to see someone else who's done something, see how they've done it, see what they offered to the market and what do investors want, because this would be quite a new thing for Australian investors. And I think there are also a lot of companies are looking to see what are APRA's concerns and what sort of issue would APRA consider to be a good securitisation issue. So it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing that hopefully when one comes through, other companies will be a little bit more confident in thinking about a securitisation themselves. The products in Australia, another reason I guess why securitisation hasn't been as prevalent is that the product lines don't tend to need as much capital, particularly I guess unit-linked type policies. You don't need that much capital to write a unit-linked product. I guess the CBA transaction, though, shows that it could be a very valuable source for a securitisation. And with lifetime annuities, we all know that they're probably one of the most capital-intensive products in the industry, but partly for that reason, sales have dried up. And given that and the stage we are in the product cycle, most companies should be seeing a bit of a release of capital that they've sunk in, and they're not needing extra capital to fund that. They've already funded it before. The one product line that does have quite a high initial need for capital is the individual risk business, where an agent will typically get 100% commission or more, and overall the life insurers initial expenses could be above 150% of the initial premium, so it creates quite a financial strain. So that's one particular product that does cause the industry a need for capital much more than others. This chart here, I put together quite a simple model to illustrate how securitisation could be used and would be effective for the industry. The top line you see there is basically what the current capital adequacy liability is. So that's the current termination value of the product, which is basically zero plus a small allowance for an IBNR reserve. The bottom line you see there is the basically an AIFRS liability. And then there's a middle line where I've created my own, I guess, economic capital liability. What I've done there in this simple model is basically to use capital adequacy assumptions that you would otherwise use without the CTV minimum. But the most important assumption there is how much extra lapse rate that you would have. And I didn't use the capital adequacy requirements there. I used a much higher level. I basically decided to put the lapses to two and a half times their original level to come up with what I see as a rough guide, I guess, in an illustrative model of where the economic capital liability would be. So the gap between the accounting liability and the current CTV would be what capital you need right now. And I guess what I would, one way to look at this is that the gap between that middle line would be more of what companies would like to be able to put up for capital between the middle line and the top line, and between the bottom line and the middle line, and then the gap between them is seen as excess regulatory reserves that companies feel are a bit harsh, and I guess securitisation could be a great compromise that the capital still gets put up, but it isn't quite as expensive. Moving to overseas, this year in 2008 there hasn't been as many transactions coming through. There are a number of reasons. Obviously, subprime jumps out at everyone. But that's not expected to be a long-term thing. Another key reason is previous years did have some quite large issues, and there weren't any in the pipeline even before the subprime crisis came around. But in the medium term, people are expecting people to come back to the market. In the EU, they tend to go for embedded value transactions, whereas the US are still focused on their XXX reserves. That may change if they change the XXX system. They're talking about moving to a principles-based system. But one of the key comments in the market is that people are interested in life insurance securitisation because it's not subprime and it doesn't have that taint to it. So I'll hand you back to Caroline, who's going to go through where to from here.
We thought it then might just be useful to wrap up with some reflection on where things might change in the future, and then pose a few questions to the group to get some discussion happening. I guess our first point around where to from here was just to reflect on what's happening in Europe, where a lot of the transactions to date in terms of life securitisation have actually occurred. And in Europe, as all of you would know, there is a fairly large change imminent in terms of life insurance capital requirements and regulation more generally through Solvency II. And that will create a new framework against which future securitisations will be tested, and which will provide, I guess, a framework for companies to measure against in order that whatever types of capital they use are measured and in achieving certain degrees of what's described as, I guess, tier status, in that you must have a certain proportion of your total capital in a particular level of capital quality, and securitisations will obviously fall within that. I guess one question that you could ask is this something that Australia could look to provide some more structure around how different sources of capital could be tested. One of the questions, which I know Eddie's longing to ask, so we thought we'd just get in there early, was really the question around, well, what does the subprime crisis sort of tell us that we might need to think about when looking at life securitisation? And I guess the key point from our perspective was that it needs to, you need to be able to demonstrate that there is long-term value in the underlying cash flows that are being securitised, which comes back to a range of issues, both in terms of there being robust models underneath it all, that the risks are very transparently able to be observed by investors, and that potentially people will be particularly interested in seeing how much of the risk that the originator actually holds themselves as a test as to how that the investors should view the risks. And then, I guess, as we said, some questions for the group, and really, you know, is there a future for more capital raising of this nature in the Australian market? What would it take to actually help that? Is it the lack of, I guess, precedence that is impeding people from going down this path, or is it that they really feel that they have their capital needs covered off and are optimally structured already, and therefore they don't need to, I guess, go down what can be a fairly time-consuming and lengthy path in terms of structuring a securitisation? And or are there other issues holding people back in the current timeframes, which would be things like the subprime issue and what that means right now? One point I guess we haven't particularly focused on but would be, of course, interesting for from a discussion perspective as well, is the question of how life securitisations are viewed by APRA, and the question of whether they are all equal in terms of securitisations. Is there room for more guidance from APRA around what might be acceptable to them or not? And whether the Solvency II model will provide some further potential frameworks to be considered. And then finally, given where we're at and at an actuarial forum, we thought, what is the actuary's role in this whole securitisation thing? And I guess from our perspective, in particularly in life insurance securitisation, there is clearly a very strong role for the actuary in terms of providing the sort of rigour and analysis around the cash flows that all of the participants in a transaction will actually be looking for, and particularly in the process of educating investors who may or may not be familiar with the sorts of cash flows that fall into these structures. And I think that's probably where we should leave it, given the time.
Hope that's on. Yep. Rather than me get up again. Thank you, Lawrence, Caroline. Rules for questions, please. If there is, I assume there's a roving mic out there. Or if there isn't, please, I hope it's been recorded. Please say your name, then your question. Any first takers for a question?
Thanks, Caroline. You knew I couldn't keep quiet. I'm Brad Milson. For anyone that doesn't know me, I actually structured the CBA transaction, and I'm in capital management at CBA. I guess I'd just like to make a few points following on from that. First of all, you made the comment that the Irish transaction got Tier 1 capital relief for the bank parent. Their structure in terms of the impact on the bank capital was almost identical to CBA's, and we had extensive discussions with APRA, and in the end they told us point blank, no, you are not getting capital relief at all. I think the way I'd characterise it is that they got to the point of recognising the value in the transaction, but then went and looked at the standards and said, there is no way it fits into the standards, and we're not changing the standards to suit the transaction. There was no way they were willing to use their discretion to get a favourable outcome for us. Having said that, we ended up doing it for a rating agency capital outcome rather than an APRA outcome at the time. So our focus was on how the rating agencies were looking at things. On the US XXX transactions, the reason why those transactions stack up, the XXX reserves run to approximately 30 times the internal estimates of reserves, and the requirements for those reserving is to have a large pool of assets sitting in relatively low risk securities. So those securitizations have got very little risk transfer in them, and they're basically financing transactions. They're securitizations by name only, and I guess probably quite more similar to mortgage securitization than in anything you'd call insurance securitization. I guess a lot of the diagrams and discussions led to where the pricing for insurance securitization comes together. My comment there is that you've got to balance between what's actually going to sell at a reasonable price in capital markets versus the actuarial view of risk. And generally speaking, the capital markets only price aggressively on risks that are very remote. So risks that are out at a sort of double A level of rating is where you'll get value for hitting the capital markets. Anything that starts transferring more risk starts becoming relatively expensive in the capital markets. So we structured our transaction to double A level eventually, but it wasn't economic until we got up to an A level transaction. And I think that's part of the problem that actuaries in particular, when they look and want to get real risk transfer, real risk transfer is very hard to achieve at an A level rating. I've commented that APRA didn't exactly make our life easy, and the specific reason why we focused on the funds management vehicle rather than the life company was around minimising the regulatory processes that we had to go through. Now, that's not a comment on whether we would or wouldn't have gotten it done in the insurance field, but I have no doubt that there would have been another 12 months lead time in getting the transaction away. There's a couple of comments about first mover premium, and I guess my comment there is that was, for us anyway, that was more about educating the rating agency about what we were doing than I don't think it got reflected much in the actual securities that got issued. Once the rating agencies got comfortable and got their heads around the risks, it was much easier to get the investors on board because they had some experts along who could give them some comfort about how the thing was priced. So I guess the role of the actuaries, I think, is to come in and be as an independent advisor rather than being seen as partisan. Now I've sat and had discussions with investors, and no matter how much evidence you put in front of them, if it's evidence that's coming from the person that's selling, they're going to instantly disregard it. So I think that's the role that actuaries and the consultants in particular need to be quite aggressive about pushing. And just lastly, in terms of how we get this thing moving, I'd strongly suggest that the way to get these transactions to work is to simplify it rather than to make them more complex. Now, I know I'm not one to talk that our transaction was probably the most complex one that's ever been done, but I think the ones that have really stood out as being good transactions recently have been in the general insurance space. And AXA did a motor vehicle risk securitisation out of France that was particularly good. They had an independent index that they were benchmarking against, and I think that's a transaction that should interest anyone who's in wants to look at this field. I think I've monopolised things enough now.
Bruce? Bruce Thompson from Thompson Actuarial. Brad's mentioned a number of technical aspects, and I'd like to add to that by alluding to Caroline's word perception and talk a bit about consumer land viewing transactions like this and a few examples. I tutor in life insurance, and our young actuaries learn approximately nothing about securitisation, subordinated debt, financial reinsurance, any of these sorts of things. And I got a question on the online forum, and when I answered it to the effect of how financial reinsurance worked, there was great amazement amongst them because they all thought that financial reinsurance was some highly immoral undertaking. And this is technical people. And where's this coming from? Well, it probably started, oh goodness knows, it's nearly 20 years ago, Occidental Regal, where financial reinsurance had the potential to be misused, and without getting myself into legal trouble, Occidental Regal was not a shining light in this industry's history. About a few years after that, I have an imperfect memory, but I believe it was National Mutual's then chief executive, I think it was Jeff Tomlinson, was being interviewed on one of the ratbag television shows about National Mutual's subordinated debt, and he did a wonderful job. I was working for a competitor at the time, but I was cheering. He was very clever in that he insisted on being a live interview so they couldn't cut and paste it and all the rest, but he defended what was basically an accusation that National Mutual was broke or something or other, and that it was using funny money, and he did a wonderful job. And I suspect, though, that although my perception was what a wonderful job he'd done, the public's perception was, oh, maybe National Mutual's not quite broke after all. So even though he'd done a wonderful job, he had been forced to defend, in that most horrible of forums, public ratbag television, he'd been forced to defend what his company was doing, how it was using capital other than straight shareholder capital. And finally, it was about 10 years ago, I believe I was the first to use financial reinsurance under the 1995 Life Act's new rules for it. And there was about 40 different questions that I had to answer to put together this structure. It was basically renting capital from a reputable Australian reinsurer. Sorry, all Australian reinsurers are reputable. It was a reputable reinsurer. And I sent this application down to APRA in Canberra, as they then were, and phoned them a few days later, and they were amazed, surprised, shocked, horror, and all sorts of things. My experience with APRA was positive, albeit a little amusing, because their attitude was, we put all these questions and requirements here to make sure that no one would ever do this. You've satisfied all our questions, we're going to have to approve it. And APRA, as an arm of the consumer world, had that attitude, that this was something dangerous and different. We Australians, more so than most developed worlds, we own our own house, we don't rent. We have this perception that if you haven't bought your house, that you're in a less safe financial status somehow. And I think if we're investing our long-term savings, we're expecting that that company's going to be big, safe and friendly, to quote an old advertisement. When we see them using, whose word was it, tricky methods or tax-driven or something, where the perception is they don't have enough money. Well, why am I giving my money to them if they don't have enough? So a lot of the reasons that Caroline and Lawrence put up apply around the world, but in Australia I think we have a perception problem that says if you're going to use unusual means of capital, the perception is you're not as big, safe and friendly as the one down the road. And that's, to me, the problem that that we as the financial engineers are having to overcome. It's this perception problem.
Cheers, Mike Thornton from AXA. Thanks for mentioning the AXA example, Caroline. I didn't see that coming. I just thought I'd make a couple of observations about that. If, I did a little bit of work on that, and it might not be widely known that, but it did benefit Australia in a roundabout manner. So what the AXA Group did was did a securitisation in Paris, and then translated that into back-to-back reinsurance arrangements around the world, so that the AXA entities were able to get pandemic reinsurance. And essentially what it allowed us to do was to get capacity and a reasonable price for pandemic reinsurance that just was not available in the reinsurance market. I don't know if people in the room tried to get pandemic coverage around 2006, but it was not straightforward. There wasn't a lot of it, and what little there was would cost you an arm and a leg. So, I mean, the learnings for me were that it's quite complex to do. It does take time. I'd certainly echo the comments that you need to spend a lot of time explaining the product to the rating houses. But there's no doubt that there's interest in the capital markets. There are certainly investors out there who are prepared to put money into these sorts of securities, and I think we're missing a trick in Australia if we can't replicate that here. So I certainly, for one, will be I think advocating APRA to put some principles-based guidance in place. And it does seem to me that at the moment they don't have much incentive to do so, and as a result, are necessarily going to approach everything with a lot of scepticism. And I'm not sure that's necessarily in the industry's best interests.
Thank you. I'm Robin Knight from ING. Now, Mike may have answered half of my question. Certainly from a retail risk point of view, there's clearly a very strong need for cheaper access to funding. And I'm wondering more about the reinsurer's role in this. I mean, the reinsurer would have a good understanding of the different life companies. Maybe they can reinsure more risk and package it up to access markets overseas where effectively taking onto their balance sheet. What are your views on the role of reinsurers in terms of understanding the life companies, maybe packaging it up so that there's more diversification, farming the risk off overseas?
I think
we've
got a question here. We can actually say something back here.
Might be one for Eddie as much as...
I think all your points are right in terms of the reinsurers having obviously knowledge and awareness of the portfolios and the companies and so forth. I guess the only counter to that is that the reinsurers really are already highly exposed to the similar risks themselves. And I guess one argument would be that it's other investors who have different risks who might be looking for some sort of a diversification who might find these sorts of things attractive as well. So you take yourself away from those investors, but as you say, towards a pool of investors who are very familiar with the risks associated.
I guess another thing to add, it is possible for the reinsurers to use securitisation. So I guess doing what you suggest, bundling up different portfolios. I guess the disadvantage of that is that things will become a little bit less clear and transparent, at least in some people's minds, the underlying investors. But so that's another option.
Yeah, I'll do a chairman's question. I probably want to toss this on its head. Probably securitisation from the point of view of an asset class for a life insurance company to invest in. To me, it seems like if you could potentially find two friendly life insurance companies in this market, which I know we're all competing against each other very hard, but it sounds like it could be an opportunity for basically to cross-invest to solve the capital issues, especially around risk business, that one could package up their DAC or whatever you want to call it into an investment vehicle for a life company to put some of their shareholders' money, or sorry, policyholders' money in, and if that company do the exactly same thing, to be friendly towards each other. Any thoughts about whether arrangements like that would be possible? Of course, it all depends on what APRA's view about what capital adequacy requirements you would have on such an asset class as a securitisation of a liability as a life company. At the moment, I think it would probably fall through so many holes that you could get away with it, especially if it's an A-rated bond or a AA-rated bond. You'd only have to put the credit risk on it, not the, assume your mortality is going to be X and your lapse rates are going to be X.
I guess what you're saying is that there's a matching profile there, I guess, especially for the lifetime annuity business. So it's certainly possible, and superannuation investors as well, who might not have a lifetime annuity might like a long-term asset. So it's definitely possible, but I guess the key in there is whether APRA would be comfortable with that. But I personally don't see a problem with it, especially if it's not one company doing it within its own sphere and is actually two separate companies and it's arm's length.
Thanks. G'day, my name's Sam Wills from UNSW. I guess the perspective I'm coming at this from is last year I wrote a paper on this very topic on securitising longevity risk. And one of the problems we came up against was in pricing. And I noticed you mentioned the chicken and the egg problem. So what sort of methods are there available to sort of overcome that chicken and the egg problem and sort of arrive at a price before coming to issuing it to the market? Like to sort of feel out what the market's taste for longevity risk is.
I guess the way to taste the market is really to talk to investors who will have a relatively clear view on what they think is an appropriate return for the risks they're taking on. So that would be where I would start personally. I guess as Brad touched on earlier, though, they're not so much. I mean, longevity is probably not where people have been testing it so much in Australia to date, but where it becomes quite tricky, to use the word again, from a securitisation perspective, is the balance between how much risk you need to transfer from APRA's perspective versus how much risk you need to transfer to get the price you want.
Can I ask, is anyone here from APRA who'd like to give an APRA view about these things?
Oh, just a very general one, that I think there's another player in all of this too, and that's the tax office. That it might be obvious to us that a capital initiative actually means you should be able to release it as capital rather than unfranked dividends. If we've had complications explaining it to rating houses, I'd be quite interested to know what it'd be like describing it to the ATO as well. So it just seems to me that they should be another partner in the whole exercise.
Hi, James Collier from KPMG. Just a quick observation, probably a comment on your question, Sam. I was involved with Bluestone Mortgages when they looked to securitise their reverse mortgage portfolio, and I guess a lot of that really revolved around your question about longevity risk. Was the first time the market had to consider it. It involved a fair bit of education as well of the ratings agencies as well as the mortgage insurers. Probably the most difficult aspect of it was really enough proof to give them in terms of quantitative analysis to support our views on the variability of the underlying risk. If you're thinking what you have to support longevity variability, you could look back to the Australian life tables back to 1896, which was 21 odd life tables, and just look at that range of mortality improvement. But you start to get into a lot of questions about mortality improvement by cohorts and those types of questions we've looked at. It comes back to something that Brad said earlier as well about you end up as the person who's doing the securitisation, that the market only really wants to accept the AAA, AA debt, that you do need to get to the perspective of you've got to be able to credit wrap the whole offering such that you basically accept the lower tranches yourself and put enough protection on the passing of that risk to the market, because there's not enough understanding to be able to take the lower tranches of any such securitisation.
Any one last question before I give it a close? thank you all for your contributions, and most of all, thank you to our two presenters.